Welcome to the Fashion Law Network podcast series. My name is Kasia Zabrowska-Traubin. I'm a patent attorney and fashion enthusiast based in Los Angeles, California. Join me as I break down legal cases, discuss recent fashion news, and demystify patent law. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the premiere episode of the Fashion Law Network podcast series of season 6. I can't believe I recently celebrated the 3rd year anniversary of this podcast. I hope everyone had a wonderful summer. And as I mentioned during my last episode, I was fortunate enough to travel to Europe this summer. It was actually my first trip back there since COVID. First, I went to Poland to visit my family who lives there. Some live right in Warsaw, some live a little outside of Warsaw, so I went there. And then we were off to the Amalfi Coast in Italy. It was such an amazing trip, and it felt quite apropos to go to Italy during my 3rd year anniversary month of the podcast, as Italy was one of the first countries to truly embrace my podcast, as it's been consistently in the top 10 charts for the business news category in Italy, according to the podcast tracking chart. Of course, that wasn't the only reason I went to Italy, but it did turn out to be perfect. And I posted a few photos of my trip to my Instagram account, PatentLawyerLA, if you guys want to check it out. So I spent quite a bit of time thinking of the perfect episode for the premiere of season 6 of this podcast series. And once I signed into Pacer, which is the electronic access service for all U.S. federal court documents, and that's the site that I use to pull all my court documents that I use on the series, I saw a slew of filings by Chanel in July and August. So, of course, it made my decision very easy. I knew this episode had to be all about Chanel, as they have been very busy in the legal sense lately, which of course is not surprising, as I've mentioned many times before how strong their intellectual property protection is and enforcement. They're really at the forefront of enforcing and really cracking down on counterfeiters, among many other intellectual property issues that Chanel faces. I then found a few updates on the Chanel versus The Real Real case, which is where this podcast series originally started from. I was so fascinated by the lawsuit back then that Chanel was and still is waging on The Real Real, that when a seminal order came out for that lawsuit back in March of 2020, that is truly what inspired me to pick up a microphone and start this podcast series. Because I remember I was always looking through the podcast app, looking for any sort of information on legal lawsuits or Chanel and The Real Real, and there was just nothing to be found. So here I am to fill that void for everybody. So here we come full circle now, 3 years later, where there may be some sort of resolution of that case with a few things that have happened over the summer, which I'll get into in the later half of this episode. Oh, and while doing research for this episode, I came across an old Chanel lawsuit from 2011, which has nothing to do with IP, but is really interesting nonetheless. According to Rack.com, the headline that they came up for this lawsuit was "Woman Sues Chanel After Getting a $10,000 Ring Stuck on Her Finger." According to that website, a Chanel shopper in Brooklyn got one of the rings at the Chanel store on the East 57th Street stuck on her finger, and then she ended up winding up in the emergency room for 3 hours trying to get it off. Doctors were able to remove the ring that her lawyer said was worth, quote, at least $10,000 without cutting it. And then she sued Chanel for unspecified damages in Brooklyn court. In my opinion, perhaps the thinking here was that the Chanel employees coerced her into trying this ring on, and maybe she said it was too small and didn't want to. This is pure speculation, I'm guessing. Not sure. Maybe some of her damages were pain and suffering. Anyway, back to IP. I will be staying to my true format of the podcast series on this episode. I will first go over a brief history of the Chanel Fashion House, Then I'll go over a few new trademarks and patents that Chanel has filed recently, the slew of lawsuit filings that Chanel has been involved with over the summer that I mentioned in July and August, and then I'll go over the status updates on the Chanel versus The Real Real case. So here we go. Okay, so let's begin with some history of the Chanel Fashion House. There is a very rich history here, which I could easily make into a 1 hour or longer episode just on the history part. But since I try to keep my episodes under 30 minutes, I'll try my best to go over just the most pertinent and most interesting facts in my opinion. So according to biography.com, it all started in 1883 when Coco Chanel was born. Her real name was Gabrielle Bonheur Chanel, and she was born in Western France. She had what seemed like a very difficult and almost tragic childhood, as her mother died when she was only 12. Her father was a peddler, and he ended up putting Coco Chanel into an orphanage, probably because he was unable to care for her. But when she was in the orphanage, Chanel was raised by nuns who taught her how to sew. And it's reported that the nickname she chose for herself, Coco, since her real name was Gabrielle, was a name that she chose for herself as a stage name, which she used during her brief career as a singer. So then let's fast forward to when Chanel was 20 years old. She met a friend who helped her start a millinery business in Paris, which is the business of hat making. She then opened her first shop selling hats on Paris's Rue Cambon in 1910, so she was only 27 at the time. And then she opened up a few other stores in various cities and also started to make clothing. Her popularity was steadily rising, and she was also pretty famous in the artist world, as she designs costumes for a few famous ballets. And it's also reported that artist Pablo Picasso was one of her close friends. So then let's fast forward to 10 years later. In the 1920s, Chanel really expanded her already very successful business at the time when she launched her first perfume, Chanel No. 5, which of course is still around, probably one of the best-selling perfumes in the entire world. And according to biography.com, the perfume was backed by department store owner Bader and businessman Pierre Wertheimer and Paul Wertheimer. A deal was ultimately negotiated where the Wertheimer business would take 70% of the perfume profits, and they were producing the perfumes at their factories, with Chanel herself only receiving 10%. And it's reported that over the years, with the perfume Chanel No. 5 being a huge source of income, she repeatedly sued to have the terms of the deal renegotiated. Then in the 1920s, Chanel also introduced two legendary fashion designs: the Chanel suit, which is pretty synonymous still with the collarless jacket and the kind of pencil skirt, and then the little black dress, which was pretty revolutionary at the time, as black was typically reserved for mourning, and she kind of showed how it could be worn in other ways. Then, unfortunately, came the economic depression of the 1930s and the outbreak of World War II, which caused Chanel to close her businesses. She left Paris and moved to Switzerland for a while. Then in the early 1950s, she made a return to the fashion world despite being 70 years old. And it's reported that she actually lived at the Ritz Hotel in Paris for many years when she returned. Then Chanel died on January 10th, 1971 at her apartment at the Paris Ritz. And I've actually had the amazing opportunity to stay at this hotel a few times. And they have a Coco Chanel suite where you can stay, which is where Chanel used to live. I think it's about 18,000 or 20,000 euros a night. And I've never been inside. I've never seen it. But but I have walked past it on the second floor of the Ritz Hotel. So that's probably about as close as I've ever gotten to this amazing piece of Chanel history. Then, a little more than 10 years after Chanel's death, legendary designer Karl Lagerfeld took the reins at the company as creative director, and he continued the Chanel legacy. Unfortunately, in February of 2019, Mr. Lagerfeld passed away, and his kind of right-hand woman, French designer Virginie Viard, was appointed as his successor, and she is still currently the creative director for the Chanel Fashion House. The Chanel Fashion House is currently owned by the Wertheimer family. If you recall earlier, I discussed the Chanel No. 5 fragrance, which was in fact backed by the department store owner Bader and the two businessmen Wertheimers. I think they are the grandparents to the owners now. Chanel is the owner of many trademarks and patents. So first, let's define what exactly is a patent. A patent is a form of intellectual property that gives its owner the legal right to exclude others from making, using, or selling an invention for a certain amount of years, and that's in exchange for publishing a public disclosure of the invention. Now, this is where a patent attorney like me comes in to write the patent application for the inventor. And to get a patent granted, your invention must be useful, novel, and unobvious. That's kind of the legal standard. And you can even patent something that already exists, as long as the improvement that you make yields unexpected results. The hallmark example of this so-called improvement is the Thomas Edison light bulb. Thomas Edison didn't really invent the light bulb, but he did significantly improve upon the technology by developing a light bulb that used a lower current electricity and an improved vacuum inside the globe. And his light bulb lasted 40 to 60 days versus only a few hours at a time, as were the original light bulbs before he came in to kind of reimagine the light bulb. And there are three types of patents. The first one is a utility patent, and this is a patent that protects the way something works. So, for example, the mechanism of a new pump on a cosmetic item. Second type of patent is a design patent, which protects the ornamental nature of the item only. So, for example, the shape or look of a Chanel flat bag, the way the strap is configured. And Chanel has a really interesting design patent, among lots of other ones, for the unique rectangular clasp that is used on all the Chanel boy bags. And then the third type of patent is a plant patent. It's relatively rare. This is a patent that's granted to a person who has created or discovered a new and distinct asexually propagated plant. Obviously, this does not come up in the fashion context very often. Chanel, true to form, has been very busy with protecting their various inventions with many patent filings. They have a few published patent applications recently. Most recent one, filing date of February 2023, and the app got published just recently, August of 2023. It's a utility patent titled Applicator for Cosmetic Product Comprising a Movable Part Having at Least One Chain of Open Loops. So in reading through this patent application, it seems to be mostly for a mascara wand, which seeks to solve the issue of retaining enough mascara product on the applicator. The beginning of the patent application may be interesting for some people. It kind of discusses the problem to be solved by the invention. So here, the inventors for Chanel state that it is desirable to design applicators having a good capacity for retaining cosmetic product that lead to good separation of eyelashes, a good effect of elongation and curving of the eyelashes. Similarly, it is sought to configure the applicator to provide the best possible application quality, in particular, the best regularity with simple manipulation. And then they talk about the actual wand, wherein the configuration of the movable part in the form of chains of open loops procures high mobility and increased flexibility of the movable part, which increases the advantages described above. So I think here there's also drawings with it where you can see it. But you know how on a mascara wand, it has these loops at the very top, and at the top they're smaller, and at the bottom they get larger, typically, depending on which kind of volume or length the applicator is trying to achieve. Now for trademarks. So a trademark is a symbol, word, or words that are legally registered or established by use as representing a company or product, and they can be split into two different types. There's a character trademark and a logo trademark. So character marks protect the actual word, the brand name of a company or product. So for our example here, it would be the Chanel word, although that's not the only character mark that Chanel owns. And then the logo is the symbol associated with the company. So here, one logo that the company owns is that kind of capital CC, which is synonymous with the company.
In going back to the United States Patent and Trademark Office database, I'm looking up just a few more Chanel trademarks here. I see that their attorney filed a few new marks, one for the word Chanel under the category of compact mirrors just about 3 weeks ago. Also in the same month, another word mark CC for International Class 025, which is apparel, and 39. So footwear, gloves, headwear, hosiery, scarves, swimwear, bottoms as clothing, dresses, outerwear, tops as clothing, belts. And then back in June of, also just as an aside, I'm confused, or I'm wondering why it took them this long to file a trademark for apparel and belts with the CC mark. Seems like they should have done that much earlier. Anyway, then back in June of 2023, they filed a logo or a stylized mark for the word Chanel, all in capital letters. And each letter is a different, like, rainbow color, also under that 25 category, which is apparel. Obviously, one of the most popular categories for fashion companies. And in June, they filed for the word mark Chanel under the nail care category for some items like nail art, nail stickers. So that's interesting. Maybe that's something they'll be coming out with soon, as I haven't seen any kind of art or stickers made by Chanel yet. Also in June 2023, they filed for the word mark Coco Chanel under the apparel category. Again, not sure why they didn't do that earlier. Or maybe they just expanded the apparel category. Sometimes a applicant will file, for example, outerwear for the 025 category for apparel, but then later they'll be selling things like t-shirts or underwear. So then a lot of times it's a good idea to file for all of those specific items also. And unfortunately, you do have to file a new application for those, because you can only narrow and not broaden your category under current trademark law. So those are just a few of the trademark applications Chanel has filed. They have a huge trademark portfolio, as I mentioned before. So now that we have some background information on the Chanel Fashion House and their kind of legal IP strategy, let's discuss the slew of legal filings that Chanel has been very busy with over the summer. So here I'm reading from that Pacer website that I had mentioned earlier. August 2nd, we have a filing by Chanel, Chanel Inc. versus Villo & Co. LLC. This is the lawsuit that is getting the most traction and most press. So I'll go over that one along with the second one filed the day before. For that, on August 1st, Chanel versus The Good Fastener. Then July 24th, they filed a lawsuit against individuals, businesses, and unincorporated associations identified on Schedule A. Typically, that means they're suing those kind of fly-by-night replica sites, I'm guessing here. I did not pull up the complaint, though. Next one, July 21st, Chanel versus 218, so it's just a number, which also probably means it's one of those fly-by-night type companies that doesn't have an actual name. Then on June 22nd, they filed a complaint, Chanel Inc. versus Replica, chanelpurses.com. That was not a good idea by whoever started that website. Chanel will definitely go after you if you have a website like that. So as I said, the one with the most press was that first one filed on August 2nd, Chanel versus Villo and Co. LLC. So I'll get into that one in a bit more details. The other ones, like I said, are kind of those fly-by-night defendants. The other interesting case, though, is that Chanel versus The Good Fastener. This one was filed a day before that Villo case, and I pulled up the complaint, 130 pages. Of course, I'm not going to read it all, but essentially it's a complaint for trademark infringement, trademark counterfeiting, unfair competition, trademark dilution, common law trademark infringement, unfair competition. So these are the typical counts that we see in a trademark infringement complaint that Chanel and other fashion design houses usually file. Of course, not only fashion houses can file trademark infringement lawsuits. Anyway, on page 6 of this complaint, Chanel alleges that upon information and belief, of course, I'm reading straight from the complaint here, defendants manufacture and sell costume jewelry products featuring the iconic CC monogram as their main source of identification and origin. They further allege that the costume jewelry is made from Chanel buttons and collateral bearing the Chanel marks that are not obtained from Chanel or provided to defendant by or with the consent or knowledge of Chanel, and they're not verified as genuine by Chanel. This, quote, button jewelry made by defendants featuring the Chanel marks includes necklaces, earrings, bracelets, rings, and hair accessories. The complaint then goes on to allege that the defendants are promoting these products online on their thegoodfastener.com website and their at Good Fastener Instagram page. A printout of the Good Fastener Instagram page is attached as Exhibit C, and examples of the defendants' posts on their Instagram are below. And in promoting and marketing their jewelry, Chanel alleges that the defendants have referred to the jewelry as, quote, designer, as reflected in the example attached in Exhibit D. They further go on to allege that defendants' jewelry does not alter the Chanel marks, and the jewelry fails to indicate that it was created by the defendants without the authorization of Chanel. Rather, the appearance of the Chanel marks on defendants' jewelry is similar to its appearance on authorized and authentic Chanel costume jewelry. As a result, consumers at best can't distinguish between defendants' products from Chanel's products and or buy defendants' products due to their use of the Chanel marks, and at worst, perceive defendants' products to be authorized and authentic when in fact they're not. So this is my own commentary now. It's interesting to point out that Chanel specifically says that the defendant's jewelry does not alter the Chanel marks. It's almost as if they're saying that if they did, there may be a different outcome here, which we know from previous Chanel lawsuits doesn't really seem to be the case, because there have been various smaller companies which sold Chanel buttons incorporated into earrings before. I think one was called Willow & Co. And Chanel still filed these trademark infringement lawsuits against them. Namely, of course, these are just my opinions. And in going to the Good Fastener Instagram page, I see they are still active and have various photos of jewelry, which uses what seems like Chanel buttons to me. They have a Chanel button on a chain that you can wear as a necklace. So yeah, I could definitely see how someone could think this was the real Chanel selling these necklaces as authentic, because Chanel does have that costume jewelry, which looks quite similar in my opinion. The main question here, of course, is how much, or if at all, can you change a design or logo item without committing trademark infringement? That is really the magic question. The case that comes to my mind as some sort of guidance was the Rolex versus La Californienne case. And I discussed that case in depth in my episode titled Rolex Reimagined. But just by way of brief background, there was this LA-based company called La Californienne started by a husband-wife duo. And they would take Rolex watches, dismantle them, paint the face of the watch and the crown, and then put it back together and sell it. They didn't, at least I don't recall, they didn't say they were authorized Rolex dealers or anything like that. The company got pretty big for a while. I remember sealing their watches in one of my favorite boutiques called Elise Walker here in Pacific Palisades and some other multi-brand designer stores around Los Angeles. Rolex got wind of these and they sued them for trademark infringement. Those counts that we typically see, and Rolex won, and these watches were quite changed, in my opinion, by this La Californienne couple. So that is some guidance we have in terms of trying to answer that question. So now let's go over the somewhat similar lawsuit here, titled Chanel v. Villo and Co. And in pulling up the complaint here, I see that the real owner of this Villo company is a person named Neely Mullins. And this lawsuit is somewhat similar to the Good Fastener case that I just went over as I'm looking through the complaint here, albeit much shorter at only 29 pages. And the complaint begins with, and I'm going to quote straight from it for now, "This action arises from defendants' improper business practices, including their ongoing unauthorized misappropriation of Chanel's iconic Chanel and interlocking CC monogram trademarks in connection with their creation and sale of costume jewelry." So we have another jewelry company here. "Defendants purport to sell 100% authentic and, quote, designer items in an attempt to deceive customers into falsely believing that their products are somehow associated or affiliated with Chanel." Complaint goes on to allege that defendants are fully aware that they are not authorized to repurpose Chanel items such as buttons to create new commercial items. Yet, despite repeated notices, defendants deliberately continue to do so. Defendants have also sold jewelry falsely purporting to be, quote, repurposed elements of genuine Chanel items that were never used in genuine products. Defendants have made multiple representations to Chanel that they would discontinue and cease manufacture and sale of infringing products. Instead, defendants have rebranded and created new social media accounts and websites in an attempt to conceal their continued misappropriation of the Chanel marks. These attempts have failed. However, as Chanel is well aware that defendant Villo Co. new additional online presence is VCC Jewel, and that defendants have continued to promote and sell their marks. So basically, Chanel asserts claims for counterfeiting under the Lanham Act, trademark infringement, unfair competition, false endorsement, false advertising, trademark dilution. And the complaint goes on to allege that Chanel sales of clothing and jewelry in the last 7 years have been over $1 billion. Wow. The complaint goes on to allege that defendants have manufactured, promoted, sold counterfeit, infringing, and or unauthorized products that intentionally bear designs that are identical or substantially indistinguishable from the Chanel marks in an obvious and deliberate attempt to unfairly capitalize and trade on the popularity and goodwill of the Chanel brand. Complaint goes on to allege that defendants have sold the infringing products on various platforms, including, and then they list lots of different Instagram accounts, websites. The first one is at Neely Mullins, Neely period Mullins, and I went to that, and I see it seems like it's a personal Instagram account of a very pretty blonde girl. She seems to be from Florida. And I don't see any type of Chanel jewelry on there. She has a little over 2,000 followers. Then I went to another Instagram account from the complaint, VCC Jewels. And that account does have various jewelry, but it's only, At least I didn't go all the way down, but I only saw Prada, Gucci, and the Louis Vuitton, that LV logo jewelry on there. No Chanel, so not sure if that was removed or what the situation was there. The complaint goes on to allege that defendants have sold jewelry and other products that they advertise as authentic designer items. For example, Villo's website, www.villoco.com. And just as an aside here, I went to that website and it says site cannot be found. So it looks like the site is down. So it seems like a lot of these items were allegedly sold on this website when it was still there. And the complaint goes on to allege that the infringing products include but are not limited to costume jewelry, hair accessories, and clothing. For example, defendants have taken buttons and other items bearing the Chanel marks that were neither obtained nor authenticated by Chanel, and they incorporated them into chains, earrings, and other jewelry that are advertised and sold as, quote, designer jewelry. So this case is a good one to monitor. I'm looking forward to seeing if the defendant will be filing an answer to the complaint here. Now let's go over the latest development in their Chanel versus The Real Real lawsuit. Now this one has been ongoing since 2018, and on July 20th, 2023, the parties filed a joint stipulation proposed order to the court. And it says that the parties state as follows. The parties previously conducted a mediation, September 2021, to resolve the issues in this matter, which was not successful. Since that time, The Real Real requested the court order a settlement conference and discovery. And as progressed the case, it has evolved. The parties agreed that it's sensible to now conduct another mediation to amicably resolve this matter. The parties wish to mediate in an attempt to resolve the claims and have scheduled the dates of mediation to be conducted in the first 2 weeks of September. So it looks like they probably just ended. And they're requesting a stay of litigation pending mediation, as it would promote economy of time, effort, and resources of the court and parties. And it would permit the parties to focus their efforts on the mediation in the aim of reaching a successful result. And then I see that on July 20th, the lawsuit was stayed. So a stay is usually issued by a court as a stay of proceedings, meaning preventing litigation from continuing, and it's usually only temporary. So according to that, it seems that the parties here are really looking to come to some sort of agreement without having to continue going through the whole litigation procedure. It has been going on for, I think, over 5 years now. I'm sure the parties are tired of this long ongoing litigation. I can't imagine the costs associated with that. Perhaps they can come to an agreement during the stay, get this behind them, move on. The only part that will be disappointing for us at the Fashion Law Network is because the settlement will almost certainly be confidential. So we'll never know what the actual outcome will be, but we'll see. I'll definitely keep my eye on that case. And on that note, let's conclude this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in, and come back soon for episode 2 of season 6 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. Thank you. Bye.